Welcome to episode 2 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Major Gary Davenport. He's a U.S. Space Force officer with 18 years of military experience. Gary is also a research fellow with the Air Force Academy's Institute for Future Conflict. At the same time, he's deputy director of the Eisenhower Center for Space and Defense Studies and teaches in the Department of Political Science. Major Davenport's research project explores adapting the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, or CRAF, or CRAF for short, as a model for the space domain, which has come to be known as the Commercial Augmentation Space Reserve Fleet, or CASR. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity mentioned herein, and should not be construed to do so. So with that as an introduction, welcome, Gary. Let's talk about your research. What prompted you to start looking into the CRAF model for space in the first place? Was there sort of an initial idea where this you can trace this back to?
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me. So the first idea for crafting the CRAF model for space was just talking to pilots here at the Air Force Academy. When I first got assigned here to the Institute for Future Conflict, we had to come up with a research idea of what we wanted to actually research and take a look at. I had several rolling around in my head that I probably will continue to research. But the idea of the CRAF model has been implemented for now for 70 years, and it seems like it's just high time that we have a similar model for space. We've used it in other domains, the air domain and the sea domain. Why not the space domain?
So if the question is why not, what leaps into the void for that why not? What's been an impediment to that taking shape?
Okay, so space has always been a benign area. You look at the air domain in its early days, there was no need to do anything like that. It was really because of the Berlin airlift. It was the spark for the CRAF model, the Civil Reserve Air Fleet. So in order to provide aid to Berlin when the Soviets were cutting them off, we had to conscript a bunch of American civil aircraft in order to have that air bridge and deliver millions of tons of cargo over almost a one-year period to Berlin. This turned out to be a huge success. So then in 1950, they decided, hey, why not we, with the National Defense Production Act, make this a formalized process? And so then suddenly there was a time where it made sense for it to actually come to existence. I think in space, we're approaching that same thing. We're coming to a point where we actually need to have more capability, flexibility, and resiliency than we currently have, which will support deterrence in space.
Okay, so there's two pieces you mentioned there. One's the overall need, and then there's the support for deterrence. Let's pick those apart in order. Because I think for people that are listening to this that aren't necessarily space experts, what would it look like? I think you gave a good analogy there with the Berlin airlift. People probably know that from history, or I hope they do, given that's was a very important thing for U.S. and European engagement. But they were delivering everything from coal to chocolate bars.
Right.
What would a spacecraft or CASR do?
So it's a lot larger than the Civil Reserve Air Fleet. So in the air domain, it's just delivering people and cargo. In the air domain, it's only been used 3 times in its entire 70-year history, most recently with the evacuation of refugees out of Afghanistan. We didn't have the capacity to move that many people in that amount of short of time. So looking at the space domain, space is big, and the amount of resources needed to act in space are going to be giant. Looking at some of the areas that we can actually leverage a CRAF model in space, obviously would be space lift. So if we need to lift some cargo into space in a quick fashion, unless we already have those vehicles on contract, we need a mechanism that would allow us to jump the line and take over existing rockets that are ready to be launched. And so by having a CRAF model, you already have that legal and policy set up in order to activate that mechanism, turn that switch on, if you will, to jump your spot in line. Of course, this is a lot bigger than just moving people and cargo in space. There's a lot more sectors or industries that are going to be needed to be looked at. One big example I'm looking forward to is orbital space service vehicles. So right now there's just a few companies that are doing this, that are having satellites on orbit that can actually service other satellites. That means refueling or repairing or attaching mission extension pods or doing debris cleanup. So as we continue to push and explore in space with Artemis, as we look to the moon and Mars, we're going to need ways to go up and do astronaut rescue or tourism for tourist rescue or some sort of service vehicle repair or refueling. Moving in past just service vehicles, there's communication satellites that sometimes we're going to need in a conflict, additional bandwidth, or in a humanitarian crisis, additional bandwidth. And having the contract set up that we can quickly leverage partnerships with commercial companies that have agreed to sign up that we shouldn't be using often, just like with craft. But it allows us to quickly turn those resources on. And why would I might be jumping ahead of you a little bit here, but why would a commercial company want to do this? Well, there's incentives that we're going to have to build into these things. So with the airline industry, they make good money by participating in craft. They get to be part of the city pair system that we currently have. So in the military, we use something called the defense travel system. If you want to be an airline part of that, moving hundreds of thousands of flights a year, you need to be part of the craft system. That gains you access. So we need incentives like that that kind of generate revenue for our space industry. And so I think there's several ways we could do that, but that incentives would be advantageous to us, the military, the DOD, because we're going to have the ability to turn on those levers and have additional flexibility and resiliency when needed, or additional capacity. And for them, there's a lot of revenue to be made, right? As long as we don't abuse it, I don't see why the industry wouldn't want additional cash flow so they can grow. And that's a win-win for the commercial companies, and that's a win for the United States as a whole.
It would seem like that gives them an incentive maybe to put more capacity in orbit, which otherwise they might limit unless they knew there was a potential demand for. So if there's a mechanism for that, there's a way for a commercial company to sort of take a risk, which maybe is a good thing overall. I'm trying to remember, and correct me if I get my facts wrong, but wasn't back in the 90s Iridium a big risk that didn't necessarily pan out entirely on the commercial side, but it did have government applications? And some of the early photo reconnaissance systems were, again, risky in terms of we weren't sure there's a domestic market for them, but they created additional capacity, which probably has been useful even without this sort of CASR model.
Yeah, I think we can argue that all the investments that we, the United States, have made in space has paid off. It's advanced our technology. And where we would be, you know, where would we be without all those investments today in the space? Today, the United States, the world, is very dependent on space for its economy, for defense. And unless we made those initial investments, I think the biggest example being the Global Positioning System (GPS) was initially developed for military use, but now everyone has it on their iPhone. You couldn't get to work or to a vacation without having GPS in your car. So, because of an initial military-only application, it's now leveraged everywhere worldwide. And I think more investments can be made through the craft model for space that will have benefit for humanity going forward.
Could you envision a next-generation GPS that was built commercially that then the United States or other allied governments had, you know, CASR access to? But is it, since it's that important for so many other industries, would it be something that could be commercialized?
I mean, it is. And the thing is about GPS specifically is the United States Space Force already gives it out for free to everybody. Even though it's meant for defense use, we provide it to the world for free. I think there are endeavors already underway through commercial industry to make GPS-like signals, GNSS, available through just low Earth orbiting satellites that are already there just using their timing signals, and that's going to give more resiliency. So even if a GPS were to fail or be attacked and attrition were to take place, there are other mechanisms that'll come online through commercial means that'll provide PNT, the position, navigation, and timing signals that the military relies on, but so does the entire U.S. economy and the world economy, frankly.
Well, let's pick up on that second comment that you made earlier, and that's the tie-in to deterrence. Mm-hmm. To what extent is the deterrent effect of a CASR, I'm using an acronym perhaps a little too much here already, but a Civil Reserve Space Fleet model, mm-hmm. beneficial and in what way to deterrence?
Yeah, okay. So two things. One is resiliency, the second being flexibility. So first, with the resiliency piece, we only have so much organic military capability in space. And by having the resiliency piece, we have just a backup capability, right? If we've got commercial satellites up there that are already doing missions just for purely commercial use, if a war of attrition were to take place in space, we can call upon those assets, right? And also, we'd have the ability to quickly reconstitute our assets in space. They might not be as exquisite as some of the capabilities we have on orbit now, but the ability to put anything on orbit quickly would allow us to get back in the fight. And then the second piece being the flexibility. It's just the ability to surge wherever and whenever we need it. Many fights that we are really going to care about are going to be in a specific AOR, area of responsibility, such as Indo-PACOM, looking at the Taiwan scenario. We might want to get more assets overhead if there were to be a fight in that region. So having the ability to surge is going to serve us very well in that case, and a joint fight or supporting a different commander. Rapid technology evolution is another one that's great for flexibility. So if you look at military assets, a lot of them are pretty old, like MILSTAR, a satellite that I'm very familiar with that I used to command and control a decade ago, was launched in the 90s. But it's critical, right? It's critical for us for our NC3 capabilities. You look at today, we've got companies like Starlink that are launching satellites. Every month, they're putting up 60 new satellites. And that enables rapid technology evolution. They're putting up these proliferated LEO constellations that the military just doesn't have anything like that. So we need to leverage that rapid technology evolution. And finally, for flexibility, it's just strategic messaging. So when you look at the craft model in the air domain, it gives the SecDef and the president the ability to send a strategic message to the world when we mobilize. We don't even have to do anything. Just simply calling up the craft, or in this case, the spacecraft or the commercial augmented space reserve, just by activating that, it sends a message to our adversaries that, look out, the United States is mobilizing.
Yeah, that's a good point about communication with an adversary, and I'm going to follow up on that in just a second. What I throw in here, though, an explanation for the acronym NC3, so that's Nuclear Command Control and Communications, commonly used as a reference in military speak, but for those that are not familiar with that world, those are the systems that would be used to oversee and maintain control of strategic nuclear weapons in the event of a crisis.
Correct.
And typically, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that has been something that, going back to the earliest arms control agreements with the Soviet Union, we've more or less agreed we don't want to mess with. Whether or not formally laid down in a treaty, it's the kind of thing where you understand if you poke your adversary in the eye, your adversary is not going to interpret that as anything other than a prelude to being hit harder later on. So we generally want to protect nuclear command and control systems, or NC3. Is that basically?
No, that's correct. We'd expect our adversaries not to target our NC3 capabilities, which includes our communications piece, but also our spy satellites, that you will, that are looking for initial launch indications. Those are kind of off limits for those are strategic assets that we don't typically want targeted from the U.S. standpoint, or vice versa.
And it was the latter, which used to be called national technical means, which were mentioned in, I think it was protocols to the early SALT accords. So again, it doesn't do you any good. It probably makes your adversary expect that you're about to launch on them. So staying away from nuclear command and control is a good thing. But you were talking about strategic messaging. Obviously, it'd be a negative strategic message if someone went after our nuclear command and control, or vice versa. But if you want to try and deter and send a message that things are getting serious, let's back this down. You mentioned that just mobilization of a Civil Reserve fleet is a signal. Going back to your earlier comments, you mentioned there were three instances, I believe, where we'd mobilized the craft before.
Yeah.
Can you just briefly sketch those, and then we can see how that might have an analogy for the space domain?
So it was mobilized twice during Desert Storm, and then most recently with, like I said earlier, the evacuation in Afghanistan. You know, the first use of it was really the Berlin airlift, but that was before CRAF was really a thing. It was kind of a model or a prelude of why we need a CRAF model. Why do we need to have these contracts in place? We don't want to wait until the last moment to figure out how am I going to employ or integrate with my military strategy. Like, you know, if I've got operators in the commercial segment doing their thing and I have no idea how that works and as a military planner, I don't know how to integrate that. So you got to work all that, exercise it, war game it, figure out all the logistics out left of bang.
Okay, that's good to know. So again, Desert Storm was really the clearest example of this where there might have been a deterrent implication. Didn't necessarily work with Saddam Hussein, but it might have been beneficial with the Allies because it showed that we were willing and able to commit forces very, very rapidly. So if you're building a coalition, mobilizing a reserve fleet, reserve resources, shows that you've got the ability to bring assets to the fight wherever that may be. So, and then Afghanistan was rescue mission. Again, shows capability. I'm not sure there was a deterrent angle there. With regard to space, what would be a good example of how mobilizing the space reserve fleet would be a contribution to deterrence? You mentioned sort of an Indo-PACOM scenario. I don't want to go too deeply into that so we don't antagonize people. But in the minds of a generic adversary, shall we say, what does mobilization of that kind of reserve set of assets do to give them pause about carrying out an attack?
Yeah, so this is exciting, right? Looking at space and how it's grown over time. So let me just back you up first. You know, just I think I mentioned this earlier. It used to be a benign environment, and now you can argue it's more of a war fighting domain. So, you know, beginning with Sputnik in the early days, and then in 67 we came out with the Outer Space Treaty to kind of set some rules, some boundaries here. But that really only constrained us in one area: no weapons of mass destruction in space. Then, like I was mentioning, Desert Storm, that was considered the first space war because we brought GPS and SATCOM capabilities to outflank the Iraqis and Desert Storm and destroy them in short order, surprising them as we cut across the desert using GPS. But then in 2022, now we have what many consider the first commercial space war. And so through the power of Starlink and for communications and companies like Maxar that are bringing imagery satellites or images to Ukraine to help support their fight against Russia, you can quickly see how there are a lot more assets available in space to now fight a war or any conflict. And it's going to be hard to target that many assets in space. So in the 90s, let's say, it was more benign. There's only a few satellites out there that could be targeted. Milstar had 5 satellites. And I know that's one of those strategic assets you don't want to target, but it's a very finite number. Now when you're looking at these satellites, how are you going to target all of those different satellites? So the amount of the amount that you'd actually have to shoot down or affect is really adds that resiliency piece.
And maybe it's self-deterring because if you were going to go after the entire, let's just say the Starlink constellation, you made them inert. I'm not sure what kind of station keeping capability they all maybe have individually. But if you added thousands of satellites that used to be functioning and now call them debris,
right,
that would be very domain spoiling, wouldn't it? And perhaps you'd like to think most adversaries don't want to do that because they depend on that space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's a risk of that Kessler effect. If you start physically destroying things in low Earth orbit, it's going to junk up the whole domain, and therefore space is ruined for everybody. And then there's also the idea of entanglement, right? That you're not the only ones using those commercial assets. If I was said country and I were to target a commercial asset and take it down, there might be many other countries that I'm actually friendly with that are also using those assets that I've now destroyed that asset for them as well. That's going to complicate your decision-making process there. And you might not want to actually take out, say, a Starlink satellite because my neighbor is also using that. It might help me in the short term and hurt me in the long term.
So there again, there's the benefit for the government, at least the United States government, if we're trying to maintain peace and stability in the space domain, to get more companies providing services that are engaged by people outside the United States, because that level of entanglement is something that might tie down or give pause to an adversary that, in lashing out against us or an ally, finds itself quickly at war with the rest of the world, which is sometimes in terms of strategic communication, we like to say that, but space might actually demonstrate that fact.
Absolutely, and to expand upon that a little bit more with entanglement, part of the craft or the spacecraft model is if you were going to join my craft model, I might have an agreement in the terms of agreement that you put out saying that if the U.S. calls upon me, I could deny you service or deceive you or let's just say in a hypothetical fight with another country and I leverage Starlink, I can have Starlink turn off channels or communications or bandwidth to that country, denying them service. So there's other advantages too. And, you know, as we pump money into our space industry, we're going to be the main player here. So our adversaries are going to have to contract with our space assets and rely on our space industry because it'll be the strongest. And that puts us in a very advantageous position.
So space launch and the ability to have a healthy space industry becomes really an important part of overall critical infrastructure in a new way that probably most people haven't thought about up to now.
You know, it's interesting that it's been said for a long time. I in my research that I'm doing here, I've researched the last three administrations in their space policy that they put out have mentioned commercial space many, many times. So in the Obama administration, 43 times in his policy, Trump 89 times. And even in President Biden's policy, even though it's 83% shorter than Trump's policy, the entire thing, he still mentions commercial space and how we need to emphasize it at least 13 times. So at least for the last three administrations, there's been an emphasis on enhancing and bolstering the commercial space segment. We just need to figure out a way to do it. And I think this spacecraft is the way to do it.
Oh, very good. I noticed in your resume you'd spent some time at SpaceX under the Education with Industry program. Now, I had the disclaimer. It says we're not representing any other commercial entities or government programs here per se, but do you have any insights on your experience there that you think would be worthwhile sharing?
Only that they are very rapid in their development. I mean, we're looking at Starship today, right, launching back in April, and it blew up, and some people look at that as a failure. I look at that as a great success, right? That was rapid innovation that they're doing there. They're failing fast and they're moving forward. The thing launched, got off the launch pad, and then it blew up because it didn't separate. That's how SpaceX operates, in my view. When I was there, I saw that very clearly. I was there when they first landed a ship or a rocket back onto the ship. I built that first landing ship, as a matter of fact, literally out there with the welders and on the port in Alabama putting that first ship together. They fail fast. I think that's where they could beat the military, the government, and our own organic capabilities. Like, we're not good at taking risks. We had Gene Kranz come out, Gene Kranz being the director from the Apollo 13 mission, for instance, came out and spoke to us while we were in squadron officer school and talked about how the military needs to take more risks and fail fast. I can't agree more. And SpaceX embodies that. That's what I saw while I was there. And that's why I mentioned the rapid technology evolution being a part of the flexibility that commercial will bring to the fight. They're willing to fail fast, take risks, and really push the boundaries. I can't imagine where we would be today if we were still just relying on the organic military capabilities. We wouldn't have a lot of these. We wouldn't have Starship, for instance. I mean, we don't have Starship yet, but I think we will soon. It's going to be a game changer.
Well, game changer was very much the term of art being used when Mr. Musk was out here last year giving the Acre lecture to cadets. And just some of the numbers he quoted and what the potential for Starship is to change the game fundamentally on launch. It will be interesting to see where that goes. But that leads me to wrapping up here with the question I've sort of established, or trying to establish for the closing of this podcast. I think it ties in well with what you were saying there. But in the next 5 years, what change or trend in international relations, domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or culture do you think will have the greatest impact on national security?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. It's interesting we brought up Elon Musk a moment ago because I think he's actually spoken on this topic recently. And I think for me, the biggest impact is going to have to be artificial intelligence and information warfare. So I work in academia. Here I am at the Air Force Academy and I teach. And I look at our policies here for ChatGPT, where we don't let students use it currently. However, I think I take a different approach. I look at it as more of analogous to a calculator. So in the beginning of when calculators were invented, professors didn't let their students use calculators because they thought it was a crutch and it prevented them from learning. I think there's the same kind of notion going on today where a lot of people don't want their students using ChatGPT because they won't learn anything. I think that we're going to have to take a different approach. As it becomes more predominant, it's going to be like the calculator in your pocket. It's always with you. You have your phone on you. That means you're going to have ChatGPT on you all the time, and we need to learn how to use it. Fortunately for us, though, we have free information in this country, and our adversaries, say China, has the ability to kind of have that great firewall, and they kind of shape the information that they want their population to have. Well, that's going to be a real detriment to them as they go forward. It's that garbage in, garbage out model. So if you don't allow good information to flow into your AI, it's not going to be able to give you out good information. So I think we have an advantage there, and I think it's going to be a game changer the next 5 years, how we do it in academics, how we do it for national security, for our military planners, and for our adversaries. I think we're going to have a leg up in that field, and we need to embrace it.
Well, as I said at the end of the first podcast episode with Madison, your answer to that question raises a lot of other interesting topics we could go on discussing. However, we'll have to put that on hold for another day. For now, I'd like to thank Gary for being the second guest in this new series. We're on a bit of a roll now. Thank you all for listening to episode 2 of the N3SP podcast. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about another national security topic, which is the focus of research being done by faculty or students from universities that are members of the partnership. Stay tuned for future episodes, and in the meantime, if you'd like more information, please go to our website at n3sp.org. Goodbye.